Hello and welcome to this HCP Live Medcast titled Exploring the Role of IL-13 Inhibition in Atopic Dermatitis, Clinical Perspectives and Practical Applications. My name is Christopher Bunick, Associate Professor of Dermatology at Yale School of Medicine. I'll be the host for today's discussion, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Alexandra Gallant. Thank you for joining me today for this discussion. Can you please introduce yourself to our audience, and then we'll dive into the discussion.
Sure. I'm Alexandra Gallant. I am on faculty at Mount Sinai in New York City, and my clinical practice and research focuses on patients with inflammatory skin disease, particularly atopic dermatitis.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Gallant. So let's dive right in and talk about the need for targeted therapies in atopic dermatitis, particularly IL-13 targeted therapies. We keep hearing about atopic dermatitis being a very heterogeneous disease, especially when it comes to the types and numbers of cytokines involved. What role does IL-13 play in the pathophysiology of atopic dermatitis, and how does that inform how we're going to approach treatment?
Yeah, I think exactly as you said, we increasingly recognize this disease as heterogeneous from a pathophysiology standpoint, which tracks what we see clinically. We've always recognized there were so many different ways atopic dermatitis could present in our patients. And I think we're finally better able to explain that with how we understand the disease from a signaling perspective. I think it's pretty well recognized that IL-13 is if not the dominant, clearly one of the dominant cytokines in this disease. This is borne out in many different studies. And as we've seen our drug pipeline progress in treatments like our selective IL-13 inhibitors, which provide patients very, very high levels of efficacy, both against skin and also itch in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought up itch because the patient-reported outcomes like itch are becoming so much more important in defining clinical outcomes of therapeutic administration. And particularly, one of the cool things about itch is that actually the receptors for IL-13 actually exist on sensory neurons. So there's a reason it's involved in itch, and inhibiting IL-13 can play a role in itch. And one of the things about IL-13 that's always amazed me is, you know, it can mess up proteins and lipids in the skin to cause barrier defects. It can lead to skin infections by decreasing antimicrobial peptides. And it even, obviously, it affects inflammation. We see that in our patients, but it also can affect fibroblasts and lead to collagen and fibrotic skin thickening. And from that perspective, absolutely targeting IL-13 is really important. So as you said, when we do target atopic dermatitis patients through IL-13 inhibition, what patients stand to benefit the most from that selective targeted IL-13 inhibition compared to, say, using a broad immunosuppressant?
Yeah, I think, I think we are not quite at a place in therapeutic selection for AD or other diseases that we treat where we can, you know, predict which treatment will work best for what patient. Not yet. I hope soon, but not quite yet. But I think when I talk to patients about our therapeutic options, I like it, particularly when we are kind of contrasting against broader immunomodulators and broader immunosuppressants that just kind of have a more blanket effect in the immune system in quieting inflammation, decreasing inflammatory cytokines across a whole host, not just TH2 and certainly not just IL-13. I view the selective IL-13 inhibitor certainly as a first line therapy for, I would argue, really most, if not all, of my atopic dermatitis patients, because of what you stated before. From a mechanism point of view, we know about their role in barrier repair. We know about their role against itch. We know about their role in aiding skin clearance in these patients. So I think there's such a powerful tool, and certainly are part of that conversation for in that shared decision making process with patients when you have a systemic eligible patient for atopic dermatitis.
You know, Dr. Gallant, I'm really glad you brought up the AAD guidelines, because one of the things those guidelines tell us is they're conditionally recommending against the use of systemic corticosteroids. I think
finally.
You and I Finally,
Yeah.
that's right. I
Yeah.
think you and I both agree that there's an overuse of systemic corticosteroids in treating AD, but they strongly recommend the use of biologics, in particular the IL-13 biologics.
Yes, I was so pleased, and I know you were too, to see that almost more as a symbol of how much progress has been made in this space. Because if you looked at the last set of guidelines we had, it was right at the cusp of our first biologic being approved for atopic dermatitis. And so much has changed in the last 7 or 8 years. So it was nice to see all of our advanced therapeutics get that nod, which was also strongly a nod against still what is overused as a tool, which is our systemic steroids and also broader immunosuppressants that are less targeted and frankly less well studied to treat this disease.
Yeah, so our listeners have heard it. Dr. Bunick and Dr. Gallant say less systemic corticosteroids and more advanced systemic therapies. So,
Less steroids in any form, I would argue, and I know you would too.
absolutely, I agree with you. So let's talk about very briefly the mechanism of action of IL-13 inhibitors. Are all biologics that target IL-13 functioning the same?
The short answer is no. We know that there are in for atopic dermatitis now three biologics that do inhibit IL-13. We have two selective inhibitors of IL-13 that do so by binding to the IL-13 cytokine, and we have also those would be tralokinumab and lebrikizumab, and then of course we have dupilumab, which is our first biologic that inhibits IL-13 along with IL-4 by binding to the shared IL-4 receptor alpha subunit. So interestingly, three unique molecules that play a role in this space, which has been interesting, I think, therapeutically, being able to use all of these. I bet you would agree with that too.
Absolutely, I agree with that. And one of the points that I like to make or will make is that when you think about the pipeline of 15 to 20 bi and trispecifics in development, well, about a three-fourths of those incorporate selective IL-13 targeting. And that reinforces what you said about the importance of IL-13 and as a driver of atopic dermatitis. But also, there are so many biologics in development in the atopic dermatitis space, you have to understand the differences between the current biologics because a lot of what's coming are variations off the foundation that we have currently. And you won't understand the variations if you don't understand the foundation. So I think that that's incredibly important.
Yeah, I think for the listeners, probably nobody, present company included, understands things at the level that you do, Chris. But I completely agree. Even from a bird's eye view perspective, there's nothing that is more important when you're even in your own thought process, when you're sitting across from a patient trying to make a decision, because if you can understand mechanism and you can like really understand even broad stroke differences in mechanism, you will inherently understand a lot about the drug, know what counseling's involved, know if there is lab monitoring or not. And as new drugs come, they kind of make more intuitive sense in your brain as you're trying to place all your tools in the toolbox.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that one thing that dermatologists are doing, they are becoming more familiar with those mechanisms. And I think that is playing out and that atopic dermatitis patients are getting better care. And we're seeing more and more uptake of advanced systemic therapies. So speaking of that therapeutic landscape, where do you see IL-13 biologics fitting into the current landscape for moderate to severe atopic dermatitis treatment?
I think that I see them and I use them truly as first line agents, really for any moderate to severe. Once I have determined a patient is moderate to severe, and by that I mean really mean I'm kind of putting them in that systemic bucket. They are right at the top of mind when I'm talking to patients about therapeutic selection. Why? Because of their excellent efficacy profiles, balanced by a very, very, very clean safety profile. They are easy to counsel about. They're typically quite well tolerated by patients. I never. I anticipate you'd agree with this. I am never offering only one option ever when I'm talking therapeutically to a treatment naive patient. It's always kind of part of that menu that I walk patients through. So, I walk them through what a biologic is, what biologic I might think is best suited for them based on their preferences or their presentation, and then also a conversation about the oral small molecule inhibitors, which in atopic dermatitis really are JAK inhibitors. That's usually happening part and parcel. But I probably talk to every patient about both of these options at some point.
I think I take the same approach you do, Dr. Gallant. I tend to talk about all of the current FDA-approved options, and I put them into the biologic and the oral systemic buckets, and I sort of talk about the pros and cons of each. But I like something you said very much about the efficacy and safety. And in my mind, when I'm seeing a patient and talking to them, I always think about efficacy to safety ratio, as in terms of that benefit to the patient, benefit risk profile. And I do think that the selective IL-13 inhibitors do have incredibly good efficacy to safety ratio. And I think that there's even some particular clinical scenarios or certain patient profiles where selective IL-13 inhibitors like tralokinumab, which was our first one, and then lebrikizumab, which was the second one, could be very good options as alternatives to other therapies. Where do you think a drug like tralokinumab may fit in for certain populations?
Sure, yeah. I think we know what's been interesting about all of these agents, even among agents in that same class, right? So we said we have three biologics that in some form or another target IL-13. But even among these, we see differences sometimes in side effect profiles, in rates of quote, common adverse events that we can see. For example, with tralokinumab, we know that there might be a lower rate of ocular side effects with tralokinumab as compared to something like dupilumab. From a tolerability standpoint, this is often meaningful for patients. And so, particularly if you have that context clue of a patient that, let's say, had been on dupilumab, had some ocular changes that were bothersome, and you were considering a switch within the class, tralokinumab is often part of that conversation for me. When I think we consider the class of selective IL-13 inhibitors, which we mentioned we had two, these are the ones that bind directly to the IL-13 cytokine, we at least to date see lower rates of things like arthralgias and arthritis that perhaps might be more linked to that IL-4 inhibition. And so I think these are the nuances for me that have emerged relative to even I would argue 3, 5 years ago, where you can have a patient with one experience with one drug in the class and you can switch them to something that seems actually like it should be pretty similar, but have a different result. So that has been really illustrating to see both in clinic and also the literature catch up to that as well. What do you think?
Well, actually, I like what you said. So you're sort of getting at what we've seen in the psoriasis space where interclass switching, sometimes patients respond to a drug in the same class, and there's just no explanation why that drug should have worked as well after failing a prior one in that class. But in the AD space, sometimes switching medicines, we do see that. When it comes to tralokinumab and in certain patient populations, I agree with you about the conjunctivitis and the arthralgias, because even on the dupilumab label, it actually says that providers should be telling patients to report symptoms of psoriasis or arthralgias or arthritis. And that is because we now have more and more evidence that certain therapies, in this case, we're talking dupilumab, it may induce a Th17 kind of endotype skewing or switch. And it doesn't happen in every patient. It's a subset of patients that are treated, but it's important to recognize as a clinician that some of the conjunctivitis and the arthralgias may be related to this Th17 skewing. Now, Dr. Gallant, that's actually why we're seeing in the pipeline some therapies that are combining IL-17 inhibition with IL-13 inhibition. We just had some new data at the EADV in Paris last week. And I think that this is why we're seeing that. And it explains why therapies like tralokinumab may be very good for reducing arthralgia, as published in a case series, or for reducing conjunctivitis that could occur with dupilumab or possibly with other therapies as well. So with that said, how would we summarize the efficacy profile of tralokinumab when we think about clinical trial data, but also real-world experience?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny. I think about this sometimes in terms of how we all do this in the exam room, because often when we're talking to a patient about these options, we're not, there are a select few patients perhaps I do like a data deep dive with. They tend to be data scientists themselves or involved or like science and really want to sit and go through trial data. It does happen, probably in particular geographies, New York City included. With something like tralokinumab, which you mentioned we've had for some time now, I like to sometimes share kind of what was seen in pivotal clinical trials, which tend to have shorter endpoints, week 16 endpoints. In terms of, we know for all of these drugs, we have significantly more patients achieving endpoints like IGA 0/1, clear, almost clear. This is about 15 or 16% versus 23%, depending on the trial that you looked at for those 16-week studies. For rates of EASI 75, which is often a secondary endpoint in these trials, you're looking at between extra one and extra two, between about 25 and about 33% of patients achieving this. And then the beauty of having these drugs around for longer is then you can kind of pull in from real-world evidence, from longer studies, which we know kind of sometimes tells for a disease like atopic dermatitis a more accurate story because we don't just treat AD for 16 weeks, almost ever, I'd argue. So, what happens to patients when they're exposed to drugs over longer periods of time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that's always struck me about the tralokinumab clinical trial data, if you look at the monotherapy trials, the extra one and two, as you said, the rates are in that 16 to 23% range in terms of achieving IGA 0 or 1. And while that may not necessarily be, when you look at network meta-analyses, position tralokinumab as the best in atopic dermatitis, we have to understand that it's very difficult to compare clinical trials across trials. There's different
Absolutely.
populations, different criteria, different loading doses. There's a lot of factors that go into these trials, different stringency, different statistical applications. But the real-world data, that I think that what really surprises me in my clinic, tralokinumab has always worked better than the clinical trial data. I've always had greater responses than may be expected from that trial data. And that's what the real world, a larger real world data analysis showed, was that there was upwards of 85% of patients hitting EASI 70, EASI 50, 60% hitting EASI 75, and almost a quarter of all patients hitting EASI 90 in just 16 weeks in a real world study. And I think that that reflects more of what I see in the clinic. And I don't know, has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, I would agree. I think for many of these drugs and tralokinumab's included in that for me, the real world surpassed what the data leads you to believe you should see, which is like the best surprise. You never want to be the opposite. So that has been very very consistent for me. And I would also add that patients that stay on tralokinumab often do very well in the long term in terms of a durability of response perspective, keeping disease nice and quiet. Again, not for that 16-week period, but over longer periods of time.
I'm really glad you brought up durability, because there's a study with tralokinumab looking at treatment-free disease control. And I like that term better than remission, because to me, remission belongs in oncology. We
Different,
really talk about treatment-free disease control. So in the extra one or two trials at week 16, patients that hit IGA 0/1 or EASI 75, they were re-randomized, and some of them went back to placebo, Dr. Gallant. And of those that went back to placebo and then were followed out 36 weeks with no additional tralokinumab, up to 40% of them maintained their response. And this has sort of been called those so-called super responders or whatever, but it goes to show you that there's a lot about, as you mentioned earlier, the pharmacogenomics, understanding who's going to respond to what drug. We really don't understand the molecular details enough, but this treatment-free disease control analysis where 40% maintained that response. And I think that the median maintenance of that IGA 0/1 was 22 weeks off therapy. We're hearing a lot more, not just in tralokinumab, but lebrikizumab and other therapies, even the JAK inhibitors, maintenance of durability of response off therapy. What has been your experience just in durability and treatment-free disease control?
I think it is something we're hearing more about, and I think about it a little that it is sometimes like incongruous with how at least we treat right now, right, in 2025, because few of us say, all right, let's get you to clear, almost clear, and then completely withdraw drug just to see what happens, at least when we're treating adult atopic dermatitis. That being said, I think that it is, I love that you brought that study up, because I think it is a testament to, okay, what's fundamentally happening in this period of selective IL-13 inhibition that is keeping a proportion of these patients controlled in absence of drug. It's a very curious thing, right? And so I appreciate the data. I think we're hearing about it from Trelo, the example you gave, and other drugs in this space. And will be interesting to see kind of what doors that opens from a I think treatment perspective long term. Will we be for the right patient, will we be able to offer longer treatment-free intervals while maintaining disease control? Maybe that would be absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I think it would be good. And the question is, what is that right patient? As you just said, what
Exactly.
is that patient? That the little bit of data that we have from the treatment-free disease control with Trelo study is, the patients that hit very quickly within 16 weeks, that IGA 0/1 or EASI 90, or those that have lower IgE levels, no asthma, lower body surface area. Those are the patients that tended to do better. And that may be very useful clinical information to be able to tell your patients you're more likely to potentially have this response, or even just thinking about going down to the Q4 week dosing, right? Those patients may be the ones that can go to the Q4 week dosing after the 16 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the ability to better guess who will be that super responder that I love pulling from data sets like this, because that it makes for a good outcome and it makes for a very happy patient. And I think that it's through looking at the data that we find these context clues, which the next time you sit in front of a patient could help you make that decision.
One of the biggest topics that we hear about now is itch, itch, itch. Why do you think itch is one of these most pressing concerns for patients with atopic dermatitis? And what do we know about tralokinumab's effect on itch? And how are you setting expectations about itch relief with your patients?
Why is itch so important? I think, I think itch has always been important, and in my opinion is what makes AD different from some of the other inflammatory conditions that we treat, like psoriasis, where you can tell a lot of the extent of suffering by looking at a patient, but they itch, you can't always tell unless you're asking patients. It's so kind of fundamental to the disease experience, and across literally any quality of life study, it's the driving force of misery and quality of life impairment in these patients by far and away. I think it's become a hotter topic because we are seeing these super advanced therapy options that are delivering higher and higher levels of itch control, faster speeds of itch control, more complete itch responses, where we're starting to see that needle move, not to like, and my itch is better, but I want your itch to be gone, kind of getting patients to those deeper endpoints and trials, which I love. But I really do think it's just so much ingrained in the AD experience that it's so important that it should be, right? Because like in every patient visit, you should be asking your patients about itch. We know with tralokinumab, there's great data for Trelo and IL-13 inhibition against itch, including in their data sets. Itch, I believe, occurred as early as week one from a time point response. An extra one, an extra two, definitely by week two, an extra three, where you saw that Trelo group separate from the placebo treated patients. We know that more patients, more tralokinumab treated patients, really at all of these endpoints, past this time, experience a greater itch reduction than placebo treated patients. Whether you're looking at a 2, 3, or 4 point reduction in pruritus NRS scores, so that has been very consistent. And I think again, to your point about those super responders, it's trying to figure out, well, who is going to have that robust early itch response with a drug, and that same would apply for Trelo here. How do you view it, Chris?
Yeah, I think I view it very similar to you. Right now, obviously, in terms of speed of onset and the depth of itch response to that zero or a one, or what we call the optimal treatment target or minimal disease activity that the AHEAD recommendations or AHEAD, task force tells us to aim for. I mean, obviously, the oral JAK inhibitors do a very good job with the itch, but the biologics also help itch, maybe not always hitting that zero or one out of 10 in our itch NRS score. But the biologics do a very good job with itch too. And it comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation about the receptors, whether it's IL-4 receptor alpha, IL-13 receptor alpha 1, or IL-31 receptor. They exist on sensory neurons. And so that they play a role in itch. And I think when I started taking care of AD patients, I wasn't ever honestly thinking about itch the way I do now. And I certainly wasn't aware of the intersection between these receptors on sensory neurons and how the biologics interfere with that signaling. Obviously, they're interfering with the signaling outside the cell. JAK inhibitors are working inside the cell. I always like to make that distinction. But in the end, in order to be an effective therapy in AD, you got to have some level of itch control. And the new standards of care really, I think you and I align on this. It's the composite of hitting skin clearance and itch. It's really that IGA 0/1 and itch 0/1, that composite is going to be your optimal outcome.
1,000%, because we both know if you just clear someone's skin and you still have an itchy patient, they are not happy.
That's
If
true.
anything, the itch is always the bigger ask. It's the I don't really, sometimes they'll say, I don't care what my skin looks like, but I really, really need to sleep and I really need this itch gone. And those are the power of our advanced systemics to really, like, one thing the topicals do very poorly. And so in that conversation, I really feel like I'm probably overselling itch, because for the hesitant patient, there's nothing really else that can get us there than either our biologics or our oral JAK inhibitors.
One question that your comment just made me think about was in my own practice, when I'm talking to patients that have more or less clear skin, but their itch is not zero or one, their itch may be 4 or 5 out of 10. I tend to sometimes struggle to convince them, you know what, I'm not sure that this therapy is working. Maybe it's time to switch, because they're like, my skin is clear, my itch is okay, but the data is telling us our itch needs to be better, but the patients don't always believe that that's going to help them get better, even though we have a lot of quality of life data to support that. Have you had that same experience in clinic?
1,000%. And I think it's sometimes that disconnect between, like, how you see your patient and how they see themselves. And I like to remind myself, for many of these patients, particularly our lifelong atopic patients, they have lived with some form of daily itch literally, like, their entire lives. So the concept that they could go a day without itch or a week without itch is truly a foreign concept. And it's made me change my questions, right? So before I'd say, well, is your itch better, or like, are you doing better? And now I find myself asking more specific questions. So I don't want, I say, like, do you still itch? Did you wake up this past week? Were you up scratching your skin at night? Like, I really am trying to better understand the level of, because there's so many of them are just so grateful to be any level better that they don't always understand, and certainly don't always believe that true itch control is possible.
So we've talked about skin efficacy and safety, and we've talked about itch. One of the other very important and topics that's out in dermatology and should be out there is about how these drugs work in skin of color and special populations. What can you tell us about how IL-13 targeted biologics work in skin of color?
Yeah, so we know there are many nuances, both from a clinical perspective and also from just an inflammatory perspective or disease pathomechanistic perspective, between different skin of color populations, which clearly this is a large group of patients, and not to be grouped as one bucket. But we know that there are subtypes of patients, whether that be Asian, Black, et cetera, that have disease that has different signaling behind them or behind their atopic dermatitis, meaning higher levels of IL-17 populations, for example. Some groups have higher IL-13 signaling. I think, and feel free to disagree with me, that we don't completely know the story of kind of this endotype, right? So I can't say that it has tremendous influence yet for me when I'm trying to therapeutically select a drug for a specific patient. But I do think that if you look at some of the data that has come out for Trelo, along with other biologics in the space, I am reassured when we see consistent efficacy in different racial subgroups, which we have seen for tralokinumab, along with other IL-13 inhibitors.
Dr. Gallant, I could never disagree with you. So I agree with everything you just said. When it comes to skin of color patients, what I have seen in my clinic and what the data seems to reinforce, both clinical trials, real-world evidence, is that these biologics, as well as the oral JAK inhibitors, tend to work really well across skin of color and all demographics when it comes to race. And I think that that's it is really reassuring that we as the providers can reassure our patients that these therapies are going to work for them. One of the things that I have noticed in my patients, it tends to be more, at least in my clinic, Black patients that come in with that lichenification, those that have the more chronic atopic dermatitis, that lichenification tends to be more prominent, more scaly than maybe what I see in other races. Have you observed that, or is that just unique to my clinic?
100%, and I think sometimes it's a marker of just more chronic disease and as catching them later, unfortunately. And other times, I think probably there's slightly different signaling that is making them prone to the lichenification, that kind of hypertrophic nature of the skin that we see. But certainly, I would echo that very much so.
One of the other areas that's incredibly important, and I know you and I have talked about this a lot, and it's near and dear to our heart, is head and neck atopic dermatitis, right? About three-fourths of all patients with AD have head and neck involvement. It tends to be one of the more challenging areas to treat. What have you observed about head and neck AD and maybe the role of tralokinumab and IL-13 targeted agents in managing those types of AD patients?
It's a great question because I do find that head and neck AD among biologic treated patients can be a more difficult subtype or more difficult presentation of AD to treat. And I've actually been very impressed by the selective IL-13 inhibitors in clearing or good efficacy in this space. Because when I see a patient, particularly if they're just like kind of facial head and neck predominant, it does give me pause therapeutically because just anecdotally, I think we kind of have all, we always kind of take the learnings from our own patients and probably bias our own selections. But I have seen my own patients do very well with selective IL-13 inhibition, and that's been borne out too in some of the trials we have. If you look at subset analyses of head and neck EASI scores with tralokinumab, you see good efficacy when you go through this data kind of with a finer tooth comb. Especially at the longer endpoints.
Absolutely. I think that some of The endpoints, for example, in the Extend trial, I think around 3 years, 87% having head and neck EASI less than one. But I think that there's something really important that you and I have talked about and reviewed recently, and that is the molecular driver of head and neck AD. There's been published literature suggesting that head and neck AD without any therapy tends to have a little bit higher IL-22, so that endotype skewing compared to just IL-4 and IL-13. And it turns out that there's actually real-world evidence that at the 2 year mark on dupilumab, about 70% of patients still had head and neck AD. And in this scientific study that did transcriptomic and biomarker analysis of this head and neck group treated, not treated, and treated with dupilumab, it seemed that in that group of non-responders on the head and neck area to dupilumab, that there was an even more increase in IL-22. And one of the questions that you and I posed to each other previously was, well, how can the targeted IL-13 biologics, both tralokinumab and lebrikizumab, work so well for head and neck AD if they don't target IL-22? And it turns out there is literature showing that these targeted IL-13, cytokine targeted IL-13 inhibitors, they actually can indirectly downregulate IL-22. And maybe this is part of the mechanism of why they can treat head and neck AD and do it in a sustained, durable fashion.
Yeah, I thought that I know exactly what you're talking about because we've discussed it before. And I thought l in learning that it clinically, like I extra appreciate when things make sense clinically because that's very specifically paralleled my own clinical experiences. Even when switching from a biologic to another biologic in this space, very much appreciate kind of having that potential hypothesis as to why we're seeing that.
Yeah, and I think that the unanswered question is really what is really the driver of IL-22 upregulation, and then the downward, decrease of the IL-22 with the IL-13 biologic. Again, I think there's some molecular science to help understand this pathophysiology that still needs to be discovered. All right. It's always good when we're discovering new questions in AD.
It
So
is.
speaking of new questions, real world, we just talked a lot about some real world experience. What real world insights do you have from your clinic that complement the clinical trial data with IL-13 biologics?
I think, goodness, probably the ones that stand out most are themes we've touched on, but I think that the real world experience with Trelo has surpassed expectations set by their particularly the pivotal trials. I think that the efficacy in more difficult to treat patients, whether that be head and neck or whether that be patients with an intolerance to another biologic due to ocular complications, more of a psoriasiform eruption, arthralgias, arthritis, etc., has been very, very consistent. There have been, patients of mine who truly had tried most of the commercially available systemic options, including biologics and including our oral JAK inhibitors. That then, oftentimes, when they come to see us, it's for their third or fourth opinion, have gone on tralokinumab and have gone to really achieve complete clearance. I've had really phenomenal, recalcitrant patients. I had one in mind with really bad hand and foot involvement that had been on other selective IL-13 inhibitors, and it was actually tralokinumab that led to his complete clearance. He's still completely clear. I just saw him a couple weeks ago in clinic. So I think we all take from that. I think it's a humbling experience to see that. I think you probably agree with that. There's so much we know, and then there's just so much we don't know. And so, like every therapy we get in this space, I feel grateful for it. I feel grateful to have these options to offer my patients. And our IL-13 inhibitors are certainly in that group for me.
Yeah, I agree. In my clinic, I think some of the best examples have been patients early on when Obviously, we have four biologics approved now, but when there are only two biologics, dupilumab and tralokinumab, a lot of the patients on dupilumab that had either arthralgias or conjunctivitis, switching over to tralokinumab was incredibly effective. And the case series that we just published in the Journal of Clinical Aesthetic Dermatology, or JCAD, about the arthralgias to switching from Dupi to Tralo and having that resolution of arthralgias, it's incredibly important to understand that we have to be talking to our patients about arthralgias. And there are therapies we can switch to help those arthralgias go down. And we think we now know the mechanism, this Th17 sort of endotype skewing. But I do think that in terms of conjunctivitis, it's also effective. And we have from the six up to 6 years extend clinical trial data on tralokinumab, it has very low rates of conjunctivitis, 2 to 3%, 2.5 to 3% or so. And this mirrors, I think, the real world evidence as well. So low rates of conjunctivitis. Now, what do you do, Dr. Gallant, if a patient comes in and has asthma or allergic rhinitis? How does that influence how you prescribe an IL-13 biologic versus, say, dupilumab?
Yeah, I think for a patient with other type 2 or comorbidities, so asthma is a perfect example. Certainly, some of the other ones we see, eosinophilic esophagitis and others. I do think there is importance of that IL-4 blockade, and that usually is reason for me to at least consider that dual 4/13 inhibition first for that type of patient. What do you do in that particular type of patient?
I think if someone has asthma, I'm generally going with dupilumab just because it has that dual indication. And I think that that's incredibly comforting to know that you're potentially able to help a patient in a good way
Right.
beyond just the skin, beyond the itch. Well, you can help their breathing too. I think that's pretty important.
Yeah,
You know,
absolutely.
and also one of the things that we're learning, and I'll say for the future, what I want to see right now, we only have dupilumab approved in that 6 month to 11-year-old age group. And some of the most important data is how the systemic inflammation of AD in these kids is stunting their growth potential. It's leading to decreased mineralization of the bones. And we have data that dupilumab treatment in this group is helping restore kids to the growth curve, remineralizing that bone density. And then we have, different drugs in the IL-13 class, with tralokinumab, lebrikizumab, being investigated now in that pediatric population. And what's going to be really important for us to pay attention to is, well, how do the IL-13 biologics fare and getting children back on their growth curve and bone mineralization compared to dupilumab? Because I think that it's very important for us to understand. And the way I think about it, this is the manifestation of systemic inflammation unchecked in the pediatric population, whereas in the adult population, it may be that background MACE VTE malignancy rate that we see in untreated moderate severe AD patients. And so that's how I think about it in terms of the spectrum of the human lifespan.
I completely agree, and I think for what kind of the group has in common is the push against is that fighting this misconception that I still think exists is that there is a risk. There is an actual risk to undertreating atopic dermatitis. And I think we are just starting to get evidence because of dupilumab's approval in 6 months. And I don't think we'll know the full answer to the story for many, many years. But what if we finally treat these super atopic infants early in life? At these critical periods of childhood, what will we see for rates of comorbidities? Height is awesome. Parents love to talk about height, kind of allowing your child to achieve their full height potential. I am a short person, so I would have probably appreciated a few extra inches myself. But other things that we see, right? Like what is it going to do to rates of asthma, allergic rhinitis, EoE, like things we see downstream later in life is so interesting to me. And I feel super grateful to kind of watch it play out.
I agree with you so much. I love that statement. There is a risk to undertreating moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, both in the pediatric, teenage, and adult populations, or I should say adolescent populations, all the lifespan. So before we close, just a couple final points. In terms of injections with the IL-13 biologics, any issues with the injection process or the auto injectors?
Honestly, no. I have never had a patient turn down a treatment because it was an injection. I truly have never had a patient turn down an injection that we agree is right for them because of frequency of injection or the device itself, whether it be pen or auto injector or prefilled syringe. I think it's all about that initial counseling. I think it is really important to handhold on that first injection, teach a patient how to do it properly, how to, tips and tricks that we all amass to make it more comfortable. But I think if you're doing all of that, and you have the patient's buy-in to like, this is, my doctor feels this, or we together feel that this is the best treatment for me. I've not had a lot of pushback, thankfully.
Yeah, my experience too. Actually, even before the tralokinumab auto injector came out, my patients really didn't mind the syringes. It's about positioning them, explaining to
Completely
them
agree.
what's happening. Ultimately, I think all of the therapies that we have in the biologic space are well tolerated, from needles to the auto injector. Obviously, I think that the nemolizumab injections tend to actually be the least painful of all of them, due to a number of factors. So, lastly, any parting words on how you counsel about safety, or any other words that to our peer, any other parting words to our colleagues out there listening in terms of sequencing tralokinumab, or talking about the safety considerations?
Yeah, I think tralokinumab are other IL-13 biologics and just systemics, really the whole menu of our systemic options deserve a place in your discussions with patients for all the reasons we just shared. I really think that there are nuances for individual patients where we should be taking advantage of all the options available to us. Certainly, I view the IL-13 inhibitors as first line for many, if not most, patients that we treat with atopic dermatitis. And it's exactly what you shared before. I think it's that balance between efficacy and safety, the lack of lab monitoring, the lack of box warning, the lack of immunosuppression makes them a very attractive option. So I'm grateful to have them, and I'm very lucky to use them.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And one of the things that I said at the beginning, and I'll reiterate it here at the close, is about 75% of all the bi- and trispecifics in development, that next phase of innovation coming in atopic dermatitis in the biologic space, utilize the IL-13 mechanism of action and combine it with something else. And I think that speaks loudly to the impact that tralokinumab, lebrikizumab, as well as dupilumab as an IL-4, IL-13 agent, have had on the atopic dermatitis space from the biologic perspective. So thank you, Dr. Gallant, for that amazing discussion. I really appreciated you being here with me, and I'm sure that the audience members have really appreciated all the insights that you've shared here today. For the latest in dermatology, including more dynamic discussions like this one, be sure to subscribe for HCP Live's e-newsletters. Thank you, and goodbye.